Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's a hidden or invisible part of the internet that you may have heard referred to as the deep web, and sometimes they call it the dark web. We're going to be taking a look at that today with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He works with designing, developing, implementing security standards and protocols. And Jesse will help you understand the hidden web and also help us with our with your technology problems. So what would you like to know about the deep web? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jesse LeGrue, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
It's good to be here.
All right. So let's start basics here. What is the dark web?
So the dark web, and I guess to kind of start with the internet in general. So kind of have the internet, which let's say contains everything. And then we have what people call the clear web, which is a lot of the indexed content that we see on the day-to-day basis. We interact when we search in Google. And then we have the deep web, which contains the dark web. And it's always one of those items. You see the iceberg, and then you see the iceberg above the water and then below the water. And you only see the surface level. And that's that clear web.
So why do we have a deep? Why is there a deep web?
Well, the deep web is a lot of non-indexed content. Some of that's only available to people via certain subscriptions, via certain avenues. So, for example, you can't just view Netflix content without going through certain barriers, whether it's authentication or other avenues. That Netflix content is considered part of the deep web. Okay. So you can't just get to it. And I think that's one of the things we always think about the deep web. It's something hidden. It's something mysterious. And to an extent it is, but there's a way to get into it. Same thing with the dark web. There's a way to get into the dark web as well. And that's a little bit different than, actually, it's a lot different than what we have on our normal day-to-day websites. So we have the deep web, which contains a lot of the things we use on a day-to-day basis because we type in a username and password to get into it, whether it's Facebook or whether it's Netflix, LinkedIn, any of those types of sites.
That's part of the deep web. But the dark web is deeper yet.
The dark web is deeper yet. It's part of that deep web, and you need special software to actually access the deep web. There's specific browsers. One example is something called Tor that you can install and get access to the what they call the dark web. And, you know, always dark is associated with bad things. There are bad things that happen all over the internet, whether it's on the clear web, the deep web, or, you know, that subset of the dark web. But you do need special software to actually access the dark web. You can't just open Firefox, type in an address, and get to the dark web. You need different browser software in order to access it. And then even then, it does work similarly with a browser to try to access sites, but a lot of the behind the scenes is very different. It makes it difficult to track down individuals or track down hosts. So in general, anonymity is key. And it doesn't mean that everyone's anonymous on the dark web. There are other things, just like you would on a normal computer, can make yourselves a little bit more hidden or a little bit more difficult to track down, which is, you know, part of that end user security. If you were in a hotel lobby and you didn't want somebody trying to see what you were doing on the internet, you would take certain security precautions, whether it's using specific browser settings, using virtual private networks, so you're able to have a secure tunnel so no one can crack into that tunnel to see what you're doing. Same thing with the dark web. You can't just use this browser and magically you're anonymous. You want to take other steps to at least increase the difficulty in somebody tracking you down.
So the dark web, a company like General Motors or any company could make use of the dark web because it might allow them to do internal communications more securely, perhaps?
Correct. And there are a lot of examples, both like the seedier parts of the internet, but also good examples of dark web usage. One thing that people see on a lot of their credit cards, for example, is, hey, you know, you don't want your information on the dark web. Why don't you add this credit monitoring service, and we'll help to keep track of whether anything was leaked on the dark web. And lots of companies will do this, and there's a variety of ways to get this information, because people will sell things that you might not want to buy. But you can also actually have services that are legitimate on the dark web that aren't selling anything that's actually bad. You could be selling normal things on the dark web, but just ensuring that there's anonymity between the individual or group selling and the individual or group purchasing. A lot of the times in the dark web, you're also using Bitcoin, so you're anonymizing the currency as well, and there's other ways to even filter that further. So really, anonymity is what the dark web's about, but due to the fact that anonymity is the goal, you also have people trying to take advantage of that anonymity and do things that you don't want anyone else knowing about, but it also allows for people to actually communicate in ways that frees up some expression. So they have, for example, like whistleblowers will be in the dark web putting out this information that otherwise would put them at risk, but allows them to get the information out there. And, I mean, there's a lot of other bad things that happen on the dark web as well. It's not all good, and most of it is not. That's really the... there are good and bad things you can do with anything. There's a lot of bad stuff on the dark web, and that includes trafficking, drugs, the sale of other things that you just, you know, wouldn't want to be sold, but it does happen.
So, you know, I've got a 15-year-old daughter. As a parent, should I be concerned about this site on the web?
I would be concerned with all of the web, not just the dark web. Yes. I would be concerned with the clear web, the deep web, and that subsection, the dark web, because on any portion of the internet, there's the capability of getting access to something that you... It's not that you don't want people to ever see, but want people to understand with context what it is. And there is, you know, there are just some things you just don't want people to be a part of. They wouldn't want to necessarily witness anything that's necessarily on there either. So that protection, I would say, for all of it. But the dark web, there's a lot of stuff out there that might be a little bit easier to see, because that's the things people tend to point out most, are the really awful things you can get on the dark web. And those are the things that it's probably going to be easier to find, because more people are actually posting a little bit more about that kind of information.
Can you block that?
Via different... It's a little bit more difficult. There are ways to block that, and there... But even then, it's challenging, and that's where the anonymity of the dark web comes in, because you do have hosting that can anonymize the sender and the recipient. So it's challenging to be able to block something specific without actually physically shutting it down. There are things you can do, but it's still limited. Just like even the internet we have today, phishing, for example, phishing emails still get through filters. You can still access websites with parental controls that you probably shouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
So it's similar.
And we can assess... or access, I should say, through smartphones and tablets as well?
You can. The nice thing about Tor is that it's you can access it via multiple platforms, which makes it really easy to access the dark web. And the interesting thing is it did come out of a military project, which was about secrecy. It was about anonymity. It was about making sure information couldn't be seen or you couldn't track it down. So it's meeting that goal. It's just that it's open source now, and people can actually utilize it. And the technology is continually being updated. So it's out there, and you can get it on your smartphone, and you can even get VPNs that help to anonymize you even further. So it's possible. I've done it on Android phones in the past, but there's a lot of possibilities.
So the future of the deep web, do you think that's going to continue to expand? Or
I think the deep web is probably going to continually expand. Whenever you look at the deep web specifically, it's a lot of subscription monetized content. And I think that monetization is, I don't think it's decreasing. It might be staying the same, but most likely it's probably
it's
increasing. And whether the surface web is actually increasing or decreasing at a greater or lesser extent, I don't know. The dark web, I mean, has potential to do actually some really good things, even though there's a lot of this bad stuff on there. And I think that whistleblowing and a lot of the things people have used the dark web for in terms of activism can be really positive. It just happens that there's a lot of other really, really bad stuff there.
Yeah, and I could see it in, I'm thinking about other countries or even perhaps our own country where you want to, you know, get information out to other people but don't want people to know that it was you.
Mm-hmm. And the dark web can be a really good avenue for that due to the fact that there is greater anonymity.
Yeah.
But when anyone knows they can do something without anyone finding out who they are, people find ways to do things that generally aren't socially acceptable or aren't legal.
Yeah.
And that brings up just other complications.
Jesse LeGru, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Talking with him, started out talking about the dark web and the deep web, but we'll take and we'll certainly take questions about them. But if you have another question as well about your computer, you are more than welcome to join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Kathy in Richland County, it's your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jesse. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My lucky day, that's for sure. My question is, I have a Samsung Tab 3S, and I've only had it for a couple months now, and my files are now full, and I can't do much, put much in there. So I'm assuming I need to transfer them to the cloud to free up my storage. I don't know how to do that, and could you give me the step-by-step version? Because I'm standing here with the paper and pencil.
Okay, Kathy.
I'm one of those.
All right.
So I probably won't be able to give step-by-step, but I'll probably ask a few questions to get a little bit in the a good direction. Is the content that you have pictures, documents? What's the majority of the content that you have that you'd like to relocate to the cloud?
Right. The majority is pictures. And some downloaded graphics.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you use Dropbox or any other cloud services right now?
No.
Okay. Usually, I mean, there's a lot of services out there that you can use for this type of data migration. Dropbox is one that's pretty popular because you can use it on a variety of devices. The application itself is free. It always depends on how much storage you're using. It's got a pretty, the free service I think allows for at least, I think it's a terabyte of data, or it's at least 100 gigs. It's a good amount of storage, at least for starting out. Through the Samsung Tab, it's going to have the basically Android, and you're going to want to go to the Play Store and install the application. That's going to be the first step, is the Play Store. And actually, the Play Store, you can also review different applications they have available, including cloud storage. But if you search for Dropbox, you'll find the app, you'll install the app, and then it's going to ask you to grant permissions to storage and probably other things you don't want it to have access to, but it's going to ask you. And you really, generally, you can't pick and choose. It always depends on the application. After you have it installed, they're going to have settings in there to upload and download files. Generally, it's going to be new pictures or new documents. Uploading old pictures, to be honest, I actually can't think of off the top of my head if you can simply just go and upload all the content.
What do you mean by old pictures?
So in this case, with Dropbox, it has a really nice feature where if you have a phone and you're using Dropbox already and you're signed in, you take a picture, it automatically uploads to Dropbox.
Oh, I see.
Meaning that you kind of have that content saved in the cloud already. For, in this case, old content would be right now when you install Dropbox, it looks at the new stuff.
Yeah.
And it might see the old stuff, but it may not transfer it without you taking a separate action. And that's the step that I'm actually uncertain of, how to do it from your phone and just upload like an entire folder.
But they would have specific directions, would they not, in that case?
They would. And it's... Yeah, there are a few different ways to do it. There's a lot of online information on how to upload content into Dropbox from an Android. I just can't think off the top of my head.
Yeah. So there you go, Kathy. I think that if you get Dropbox and then follow those directions, you should be in pretty good shape.
Samsung Cloud Drive is already installed under my file tab right on my tablet. That's why I thought I needed to put them there. Am I incorrect?
You can put them there, or you can actually... And actually, Cloud Drive, I think, is a rebranding of Dropbox.
So you might already have it there.
Because I just looked at... Cloud Drive is generally I think what they consider Dropbox for Business. And that may not be free. I think that's only a trial. What you can do is if you download... You can download Dropbox still and actually upload it to Dropbox. And you can decide to use or not use the Cloud Drive. You can actually use multiple services if you wanted to. I would actually just probably use Dropbox because there's a pretty good user base. The documentation is pretty good. It's pretty user-friendly. And you could always go from there. But I think Cloud Drive's... Actually, I think Cloud Drive's a Google storage option, now that I looked here. They always try to redirect you based on the keywords, so you can use a different service. But Cloud Drive is actually something you can use through Google. If you do already have a Gmail account, that could be a good way to upload it into the web. You may actually have all of your photos in the cloud and you might not be aware of it, which is, it's very likely it does happen. So I would take a look at your Google account, and you can access it from the web, and they actually do have your contacts, your photos, your documents. Basically, it uploads it to something called Google Drive, and you can actually access your photos there. So you might already have it, depending on what you're using. You can utilize Dropbox. You can use a lot of other services. Some of them are free. Some of them are not. But if you already do have a Gmail account, log into your Gmail account, and if you go to your My Account settings, usually near the upper right, it's going to have the other services that you're using, and you should be able to find your photos in there. And from that point, you can, you know, before deleting any photos, I always like to make sure that I have a copy of them. Even if you do see them on the web and you see that they're there, I would download an offline copy to your computer, then remove them from your phone, just to make sure that deleting it from your phone doesn't delete it from the cloud. Because sometimes the synchronization does happen two ways, and it tries to mirror exactly what's on your phone. So I always like to make an extra backup if needed.
Here you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today from Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the dark web today and answering your questions about it, and also questions about your computer and your software, with our guest, Jesse LeGrew from Madison College. He is a Technology Services Group member, and I think his title is Information Security Architect. So it's always great to have him with us. Our lines are now all filled. The number is 800-642-1234, and you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to Delafield next and talk with Connie. Connie, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was just wondering, I have a credit card that one of their services is that they search the dark web for information about you, and they keep popping back saying that my email is on the dark web, but I'm not sure how helpful that is for me or what I'm supposed to do about it, if it's being used for nefarious purposes or not. Like, how do you know what to do about that if that's one of the warning messages that they pop up for you?
It's a good question. There could be a variety of reasons that your email account is listed on the dark web. It could be because your email account The credentials may have been stolen. It could be because, and a lot of different websites are different where they have you create a new username or they allow you to use whatever username you want. Sometimes that's your email account. So it could be that there is a different account associated with your email address that could be compromised. It could also just mean that your email address is out there randomly somewhere and nothing's compromised at all. It does matter what you get from the bank. One good website that can be useful to actually verify whether your email account itself has been compromised or whether different accounts have been compromised is you can go to haveibeenpwned.com, and that's haveibeenpwned. It looks like it should be haveibeenowned.com, but the instead of an O, it's a P. If you go there, you can actually type in your email address, hit submit, and it will tell you if there are specific services that have been noticed because there's been a data breach from a company that had to, you know, usually these are public disclosure, where we know we had a breach, your account was among those breached, and just make sure that you change your username and password. If you use the same password for multiple services, consider changing those other ones as well. So I don't have an easy yes or no. I would say yes. There's probably some reason it's out there. That website might give you an idea whether that email address is associated with an account that was compromised. And then you can at least go and either close that account out, reset the password. If you do know that password's been used in other accounts, change those passwords as well. And then I would have the additional recommendations. If you have multi-factor authentication, turn that on, and also use a password manager. And those are some good things to do if you note, you know, you might have been breached. But I would start there. It'll at least give you an indication of how safe you might be. Just because your account is not on that list does not mean your account has not been compromised somewhere. It's just that they notified somebody that your account was compromised and you can actually look it up.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Connie. Good luck. Todd in Madison, your turn. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. I have a kind of a simple question. Is there any way, once you put something on the internet, isn't it possible always that somebody can get that information? I mean, there's no way to be 100% secure on the internet, correct?
Correct.
Okay, that was just a simple question. So once it's out there, you can do your best, but there's always a way in if somebody knows what they're doing and tries hard enough.
There's always a way in, and looking at a lot of the different ways you can break technology to get data, it's always good to realize, too, that if you have a way in yourself, anyone else has the same way in that you do. So if you get into a service using a username and password, anyone who can type in that username and password into the same site has that capability. So instead of breaking the technology, one thing that is always a concern is social engineering. And technology can be made to be more difficult to break into and really make it pretty close to impossible. But if they get your username and password, it doesn't matter. So there's a lot of ways to get in. There's always going to be a risk somewhere. And you can do a lot of things to, you know, make things a little bit safer for yourself. Multi-factor authentications, you know, once a good one, but also to take a look at end-user license agreements. Is your data encrypted where they're storing it? Is it encrypted when it's being transmitted? There are a lot of things to take a look at, but user reviews tend to do that for you. There's a lot of services out there that will consume all that legalese and know the technical information and give you a quick yes, no, that's a pretty good service to use. But there's always a risk.
Yeah, always a risk. Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it. And let's go to Amita in Eustisford. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm kind of a computer phobe. I mean, I love my computer, but it's like they scare me. So I bought this HP little laptop some time ago, and I'm finally being forced to try to set it up because my old tablet is getting way out of date. Now I'm trying to set it up, and it's asking for the Wi-Fi password. And I tried putting in the password that's on the bottom of the little box, and it shows that it's the wrong password. So it's like, oh, yeah, I think I might have changed that. And it's like I went to what I thought I changed it to, and I still get a wrong password. And I think that was at the time that we set up our Netflix. So I'm wondering, can I just go in and change, you know, like change the password to a new password and proceed that way, or what do you suggest?
Did you get the device you're using for wireless? Did you get that from your internet provider?
Probably not. It's a Belkin. And I think my son set that all up.
Okay. So the good news is you can reset it so you can get back into the network. The downside is you're going to have to be able to get back into the web page and reconfigure a few settings to make sure you do have a secure wireless network. For any of, and this would really work for any device, whether it is from your cable provider in general, or something you buy from, you know, Best Buy or any other store. There's usually going to be a reset button on the back. You can take a paperclip, you push it against it, usually from 5 to 10 seconds, wait, let go. It'll reboot itself and reset itself to what they call factory default settings, which allows you to get in and reconfigure it using the default password. And then you can go through some steps to set up a new Wi-Fi password, make sure your devices are going to connect to it. Because most likely what's going to happen is when you do get this up and running, while you're going to be able to get this to work for your new device, any of your other devices that are already using that wireless are going to break because they're probably going to have a different password to use. So you'll need to set those devices up from scratch. But you can use the reset button. You can get the manual in a variety of ways online. So if you go to Belkin.com and actually search for the model number, normally you can download the entire manual for that device. And a lot of the times they're pretty straightforward with their instructions. They try to make it pretty user-friendly to go through it, but it kind of does depend on the age of your device. There are other services. You can actually go to different computer services, and they might be able to actually set it for you in the store. You go home, plug it in, and it works the way you expect. But you can reset it. There's a reset button on the back. It'll set it all to defaults, but then you're going to have to get back in and change those settings back. And that's where you're going to need that manual, unless you've done this quite a few times before, to make sure you can set it up again.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Amita. Appreciate your call. And we'll give you a chance to join in, too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Leslie in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I have a question that may have been in the process of being answered while I was talking with your producer, and it has to do with scanning the dark web for your name and credentials. I was breached by, I got a notice from Experian that I was breached, and I could go and take a look on the dark web, but is that not announcing my name to the dark web? I'm kind of nervous about doing it. And do you put in all of your different email addresses, including the ones I used to use at work? Or I'm sorry if you already answered this. I missed it because I was talking to the person.
Okay.
No, and it's a really good question because whenever you use any kind of service and search for something, though that search somewhere is happening on a computer, which means somebody, in theory, could say, oh, you're searching for this name. It may not be in here, but now I have this email that maybe I should be interested in. Generally, if you're looking at services that you trust, I would say it's okay to use them. But that always depends on your level of trust with the company or any other service that you're utilizing. So I wouldn't just go, on Google.com and say search the dark web and just pick any company. But if you know the company is reputable, if it's coming from your own credit union, bank, or any other service that is facilitating that, I would generally be okay using it. So if it's coming through Experian, which, their job is to help you collect that information, and they are using dark web resources to actually look that up, and that's one of those, you know, good things out there. People are actually using the dark web for some more positive things and for information and transparency. I would say you could go ahead and use it if you do trust the company that it's coming from. And you noted Experian, but I would just verify that the search is being facilitated by them. Then, you know, just make sure it's not like a phishing scam or an email or something of that sort. So just be certain it's from Experian. And if it is, I would say, you know, work through them to do that.
And so you need to check their email, the address of, and make sure that it is exactly the same as Experian.
Yep. And if you wanted to be super extra paranoid, you could physically go to your bank and have them give you the phone number for Experian, and then you could just call Experian. Because then it makes you sure that you're basically trusting the teller, that they're going to have the accurate information. They're giving you the information for Experian. And when you call them, I mean, it's direct contact. So you don't have to worry necessarily about at which point in this chain did something weird happen. You just call them directly and say, yeah, I want this. And they say, oh, yeah, we do that. If they say, hey, we don't do that, then it's a different red flag. But you can always contact Experian directly through their published number or through your bank and contact them directly just to make sure you're getting the right people on the other end.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. 800-642-1234, the number to call. Jim in Cleveland, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Great show. I had called in earlier, and you said I should call back on Monday. In that my Facebook account was hacked, and I was told that by my friends on Facebook, in that they received a second request from me to be their friend, and they said that was an indication that the account had been hacked, and I was wondering how that happens and what's the danger, and does that contaminate my other friends?
That's a really good question. And in this case, from the information, I don't know if your account's been hacked or not. It's possible that it wasn't. It's also possible that it was. One thing I have actually seen with some friends and family members recently is individuals creating brand new fake accounts that actually look pretty similar to the original account, and then requesting friends based upon your information or even one of your friends' information. So it could be one of your friends got hacked, or it could just mean that the information's out there. Now, there are a couple things I would take a look at in your case with your specific Facebook profile. First, I would take a look at your privacy settings. One thing that they'll do to try to create these fake pages is to see if your information is publicly available, which you can allow your settings to do that. So I would try to restrict it so only your friends have access to certain pieces of content. The second thing I would do is enable two-factor authentication, which you can do from the security settings of your Facebook profile. And it allows you to log in only with, you know, the username and password you have and from a phone or a different device for that second factor of authentication. So it's possible it's been hacked. I have a feeling it's just somebody created a dummy account and started trying to connect with your friends. But if you turn on two-factor authentication, that should give you a better indication, because you'll actually get notified when somebody tries to log in, because it's going to request that second factor. And if you know you haven't logged in, that's another barrier for you. So I would use that two-factor authentication to protect your account. Change your password if you're really worried as well. Although I would tweak your privacy settings just to make sure that you're only having information displayed out there for people you trust. That doesn't mean anything if your, you know, friends get hacked as well. There's always a risk there, but I would enable two-factor authentication to make sure your privacy settings are tweaked. It could be you're hacked. It could be you're not. I have a feeling you probably weren't, but you might as well be safe and enable that two-factor authentication and change your password, especially if you do utilize it somewhere else.
Good luck, Jim. Thanks for calling. Colleen in Cumberland emailed to say she's gotten texts that contain a link stating, someone complimented you. and then you're supposed to click on the link, which she hasn't done. Apple is part of the link, she says. However, she saw on Facebook that this is a way that human traffickers locate people. Is this part of the clear or dark web? And can you tell her if it's true?
And it's most likely, since it's a text message that has a link, in order to access the dark web, you need a special piece of software. So in this case, it's probably accessing the clear web because it's using an anonymous phone to just access the internet and click on something or submit information. So it's probably actually part of the clear web. It might connect to other pieces, although it's, you know, a lot of great practices were there. Look up things on the internet, see what other people are saying, and knowing that it's a scam, definitely don't click on it. If you can block the number, go ahead and block it. Although people are getting really good about spoofing phone numbers right now, too. Although in this case, it's probably a part of the clear web. The fact that you can click on it and something just works without any extra software means it's part of that either deep web, not necessarily the dark web, but most likely the clear web.
And it's probably something you don't want to click on.
Oh, yeah, definitely don't click on it. Always, if you can, highlight. In this case, it's a text message, so it's a little difficult. You just can't, like, hover over your mouse. Yeah. But you can normally highlight it and view the URL that it's going to open. And from there, you can determine whether it may or may not be safe. If it comes out of surprise and it just seems... If it seems too good to be true and you have really no idea why it's coming up, it's probably something that you wouldn't want to click on.
Larry in New Berlin will turn to you now. Hi, Larry.
Yes, good morning. I listen to a radio station that is not NPR, WPR, and whatever, but this host said that Chromebooks are definitely... Oh, a little background. A decade ago, I got... breach, and so consequently, I'm very, very cautious, perhaps overcautious. But this radio host said that Chromebooks are the most secure and that you can use those without worry. Is that true?
Whether they're the most secure, in terms of like most secure, I'd say in general, probably not. Although looking at consumer grade options, you can simply just go and buy. The answer might be closer to yes, just because of the fact the more software you have in a computer, the more bells and whistles you have, the more risks there are that you're taking, because it's more stuff to keep up to date, different accounts you have to keep track of. So having a Chromebook can simplify that a bit, which can allow for greater security. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's the most secure, but it's a good option right away to get something that's doesn't have a lot of stuff you just don't need on it, so you can do day-to-day work. In terms of, you know, other pieces of, you know, can you do anything and be completely safe? No computer, regardless of how secure it is. Can you really be truly safe, especially if you're connecting the internet? Because you also have to worry about the counts that you're using. If you think about a computer being secure, most people aren't always just concerned with what's on the computer, but what your computer is accessing. So if you're accessing email, is your email secure? That's a different question. Is a different cloud resource that you're using secure? That's a different question. And that may have little to do with the computer that you're using to access those services, but it does make it a little bit more secure to have a very smaller profile. So, yeah, I can't really agree or disagree with that one. There are some benefits to it, although I'd state you still need to adhere to best practices when using any kind of device, making sure you have strong passwords, making sure that you're using multi-factor authentication when possible, and only install software that you actually need on the device. A lot of computers just come with a lot of software. If you have less software, it's less opportunity for somebody to, you know, get into your system or to attack you. It doesn't mean it's completely foolproof, but it makes it a little bit more difficult.
There you go. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate the call. Our guest today, Jesse LeGrue, information security architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today here on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest Jesse LeGrew of Madison College's Technology Services Group. Always great to have him come by, and thanks for joining us. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to Gary in Milwaukee next. Gary, thanks for calling.
Hello. Say, Jesse just mentioned multi-factor authentication, and I want to say I have a Vanguard investment account, and the only way for me to gain access to that account is for Vanguard to send me an authentication text to my phone, which then I have to respond back to Vanguard, and then I can get in. And I thought that was kind of a slick way of making sure that, well, at least restricting or at least limiting the chance that somebody else can gain access to my account. Yeah. I'm not sure how many places offer this, but
works well for you. That's
it does. It works very nice.
Yeah. What do you think, Jesse?
It's a very good option to have text messaging, and it is a service that a lot of different companies provide, either whether it's via an application on your phone, via text message, which is nice because you don't need to install an application. I kind of like that if you don't have to install anything. There are even options for if you don't have to text. Let's say you don't have a smartphone. Some of those will actually call you, and you just read off you take a number and then you type it in,
yeah,
instead of actually doing it via text. And so having all of those are really, really nice options where you don't need to have a smartphone to do it. You don't even need to have texting if you don't want to do it. So those are really, really great options where, you know, this is an example of multi-factor with the having something. So mm-hmm. Something you know with you, which is your password, something you have, which in this case is your cell phone. Something you are could be like biometric, fingerprint, or something else. So I think the cell phone text options are really, really good.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it very much. Jim in Winchester, we go to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. I'm having an issue with my Microsoft Outlook through Office 365. I have established a password within the last couple days on that, and then I went to a place where I had to use the mobile hotspot. Seems when I come back to my regular home wireless network, Microsoft Outlook keeps asking me for my password, and I put it in there, and I know it's the correct one, but it doesn't accept it and just keeps coming back to the same screen. Now, on my smartphone, Outlook works just fine, and I'm wondering why that continually happens. It's happened more than once, and I had to go back and reset the password every single time, and that password shouldn't have to be reset that frequently.
Have you tried to access the account from a web browser on your computer?
I have not.
I would try that because that will force you to, it'll force you to type in your username and password again. Although with Outlook, you know, there's a lot of components to it, and just having the simple web interface to type in your username and password at least gives you a better indication that your password's correct. It could be an issue with Outlook or some other configuration setting that you're having. There's a lot of things that can go there, but I always like to use a web interface to verify credentials, because sometimes when you set up an email client, whether it's on a smartphone or other device, it can have a kind of a session open where it might not actually challenge for that username and password until something changes, meaning that you might have access to your account even though your password changed. Ideally, that wouldn't be the case, but sometimes it does happen. I wouldn't say it would happen for anything more than a day to have that access without it prompting you again, especially if you did change it. But that's why changing or accessing it via the web interface is a great option, because it forces authentication to your email service right away. And you can test multiple times by simply using a different browser, and it'll always force you to type in your username and password. So I'd verify it that way first, and then from there, if you still have issues with that same password, one thing I might recommend is actually trying to set up a different Outlook profile from the control panel. Normally there's a mail option, depends on your version of Windows, or you can go in and tweak the email account manually. But I would try the web browser option first just to see if that username and password works as expected there.
Makes sense. Thanks a lot for calling, Jim. Speaking of passwords, Valerie emailed to say a few months ago she noticed there was someone actively trying to hack into her Apple account. She proactively went into her account and updated the password. Unfortunately, she forgot to write it down and can no longer access her computer. Does she need to bring it into the Apple store to reset it? Is there any other way? She lives a couple hours away from an Apple store. She does have an iPhone, and she thought she could override by resetting her Apple account on the phone, but it looks like this is a master password for her computer, so she can't do it.
There are a couple things that could be done, although I'd probably go to a repair store, actually. You don't necessarily need to go to an Apple store to resolve this. You can go to any store that at least services Apples. There are a variety of ways using installation media to actually get into a macOS computer as long as it's not encrypted. If it's encrypted and you don't have the master password, there's not a whole lot you can do. But I would actually take it to an Apple store where they can boot it up from different diagnostic media to potentially reset your password. If you do have a fast internet connection, and I can't recall if this happens, if this works on the later versions of macOS, but you can actually do a what they call a net boot or network boot to installation media over the internet using macOS if you have a relatively new computer. So when you're turning on the computer, I'm trying to think of the exact key, and I can't think of it off the top of my head. There is a network boot option that might work, but you can even call Apple. They'd confirm it for you what that key is. But you should be able to go to any repair store, and hopefully they'll be able to check it out and hopefully resolve it for you there, because they'll have options for other install media that's offline if you don't have an active internet connection or a high-speed internet connection.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Radar in Waterloo, your turn. Hi.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
I've got a quick question. I frequently get friend requests on my email. And, you know, a couple years ago, I would open up the email and strange things would happen with my email. I was just wondering, is this right? Is this something I shouldn't be messing with?
It's always something to be a little bit leery of. And one thing I would take a look at if you are getting Facebook friend requests that don't look familiar from people that aren't familiar, as long as you're not randomly making friends on Facebook, I think it's just safe to delete them or even mark them as spam. One thing I would probably take a look at least from to understand whether it's spam or legitimate, is to hover over any of the links for approving or continuing on the Facebook to add that friend request. Because if it does look like it's actually coming from Facebook, you could just have random interested people actually wanting to be your friend on Facebook. You may not still want to be friends with them, but at least it'll let you know if it's something that's being generated to try to break into your account, or if it's someone who actually wants to be a friend with you. Granted, that friendship may still mean other social engineering using Facebook to try to get access to something. But if you don't know them, I would just go ahead and delete the messages. But take a look at the URL. Don't click on it, but hover over to see if it actually is from Facebook.com or if it's from somewhere else, which can tell you if it's spam. And if it does look like it's not coming from Facebook and it's spam, you can at least mark it as spam, and it should filter those out. Or you can report it to your email provider, and they can filter those out for you. That way, at least separating good Facebook invite messages from the ones that are potential phishing attempts.
There you go. Thanks for calling, Radar. Appreciate it. And Ken in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about Microsoft OneDrive. I use it for work on my work computer, yep. And I recently bought a new laptop, so I have OneDrive there. I would like to be able to access both of them at the same time. Is that possible? And is OneDrive safe for sensitive data like my financial data? And maybe even a file that stores my many passwords that we have to keep these days.
So at least from the information I was able to find with OneDrive, you'd have to use one account. You can use multiple accounts with multiple computers, but you can't use multiple accounts on the same computer, at least with the OneDrive sync application, if that's what you're using. You can log into OneDrive using multiple accounts with one computer by using one multiple web browsers, or just ensuring that you log off of one account and log into another one. But if you do want to use the OneDrive synchronization feature, you can only use one account, so you're kind of stuck there. In terms of storing sensitive data, if you do have OneDrive through work, they might have other agreements in place that allow you to store sensitive information. So I'd review that with your IT staff there. If it's personal financial information, I would consider it safe, although try to limit as much as you can. And I would actually use a password manager instead of OneDrive to store those passwords, because it stores it specifically for passwords and has better security around it for that usage.
Makes good sense. Is Avast, are Avast products trustworthy in 15 seconds?
Which products?
Avast.
A lot of people use them. They work fairly well. Like anything, there's always an issue, but overall, a lot of people do like them.
All right, there we go. We are going to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Jesse LeGrew, and he'll answer more of your questions. So you stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Jesse LeGrew back with us, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Have you been having problems with your computer or maybe your smartphone or your tablet? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll get you on pretty quickly, actually. We have Jim and Eau Claire up next, so let's go there. Jim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a laptop. It's an older one, and it's got about 60 gigs of photos and some videos on there. But I was thinking about backing it up to my Samsung tablet, and I was wondering what's the best way to do that or easiest way. Can I use a USB to mini USB, and would that work?
You probably could do that to transfer files. It does depend on how much storage you do have on your Samsung device. If it does have enough storage, you should be able to store it there. Because when you do plug in a phone, at least with newer phones and newer versions of Windows or even Mac OS, when you attach it, it can attach like an external hard drive. And then you can actually open up a folder, drag and drop your files into it, and you're pretty much good to go. The one thing that might be a little bit more challenging is just navigating the file structure of your phone, because if you do want it to show up where your normal photo library does, you might have to dig a little bit for it, depending on your phone, although it's possible, and you can do it. There are a couple other options as well. With a lot of the phones, and this kind of came up earlier too, if you run out of storage, for example, you can purchase external storage for your phone. And usually it plugs directly into your device. It's usually a micro SD card that you can get from pretty much any store that sells any kind of electronics. And they do have adapters that actually allow you to plug it into your computer like it's a flash drive, and then you can take it out and plug it into your phone, and then it's in your phone. That's another option that could allow you to access that data from other computers or from directly onto your phone if you plug it in. So microSD is an option that you might want to explore, but you should be able to plug in your phone in general into a, you know, this is a newer phone and a newer laptop, and newer, I mean probably the last 5 years. Plug it in, have it attach as an external drive, and then copy your files to it. You'll just want to be careful of the file structure if you do want it to show up natively in your Photos application, but you can do it.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Cheryl posted a question on the Ideas Network Facebook page to ask if you could recommend using any of the password storage sites.
There are a variety of password storage sites out there. One that I've used in the past is LastPass, which works really well. It does have free options where you simply can use it. They do have tie-in applications for different kinds of devices. It can integrate with browsers. The premium access is actually relatively inexpensive, and it does allow you to use two-factor authentication to even greatly secure your passwords. And a lot of those actually apply to many different password vaults out there, but I've used LastPass in the past, and it's worked out pretty well for me, but there are a lot of other great options. Take a look at there are some other kind of consumer advocate reports or consumer reports on a lot of these products. Part of it will depend on the devices that you want to use, because if you do have an Android, an iPhone, or, you know, an iPad, and you have a Windows computer, you can have a service that works with all of those devices. It's just good to know that ahead of time and pick that application that works for you. So what might work well for me may not work well for another person. It just depends on the different devices and services that you use. But LastPass works pretty well.
Mary emailed to comment about a previous call who was having issues with his email password not being recognized when he used Outlook, even though he knew it was correct. She just had this issue with her Gmail account and Windows Live. Google has a security setting to not allow third-party access to Google account info. She had turned this off to prevent access from other apps, but it also bars Windows Live. So she had to turn it back on in order to use Windows Live. That makes some sense.
Yep, that's a security feature in this case. The security feature worked in this case. It wasn't desired. So that should be able to be changed from the account security from, and this was Office 365. So changing the mail security and the app security in there will help with that. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Mary, for that email. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Daryl in Beaver Dam, you're up. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, good morning. My problem is that graphics on the internet where they show these short little 4, 5, 10 minute videos.
Yep.
It seems the picture is blowing up beyond recognizable.
So it's not showing the picture properly.
Correct. It's showing it, but very improperly.
Do you know how long the issue's been happening?
About 2 weeks, probably.
Okay. One thing there are a couple different things I would try. Most of the video platforms out there are usually using Flash for streaming. I would consider uninstalling and reinstalling Flash, but probably the first thing I would do is actually to try a different web browser. I think there's probably a browser setting or some setting in a website that might be causing the issue. If you're using, for example, Internet Explorer, I would try downloading Firefox or Chrome for free, seeing how that works. If it works well, then you at least know it's the browser, and kind of go from there. What you also might want to try is utilizing a different service to see if it's different. So, for example, let's say you stream video via Netflix. Try YouTube. Just try any video and see if it plays normally, because it's generally using a lot of the same services. And if it looks fine, it's probably a setting specific for that website. The only reason I don't recommend deleting or resetting all your browser settings is because sometimes people are very particular about their browser settings, and when you get everything reset, it can be a little stressful. So that's kind of a last-ditch effort for me. But I would try a different web browser to see if it actually works better. If it does, then I would look at trying a different video service on the browser you normally use. If that works, then I might look at resetting your actual browser settings to their default, which should hopefully resolve the issue. One thing you can also try, especially if it's zoomed in or somehow the factoring is off there, try it in window mode versus full screen mode to see if there's any difference. So in this case, it's kind of trying a few things to determine what the cause is, but try a different browser, see if it works. At the worst case, you have a workaround while you have an issue with your existing browser to view your content, and then you can always reset your settings if you want to in the future as well.
Here you go, Daryl. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have received some email from a person who apparently has a Gmail account extremely similar to mine, even some really important legal documents and so forth, which I responded to and sent back. But I'm wondering if this has happened over a number of years. I'm wondering if there's some way I can find out what their Gmail address is, if there's a way I can get it straightened out, because I'm assuming if I'm getting Gmail that belongs to them, that they may also be getting Gmail that belongs to me.
Yeah.
There, it might be very, very difficult to get their email address, especially if there are sensitive documents. The company that you send them back to most likely would not want to disclose actually what their real email address is. So assuming somebody typed it in incorrectly or something else. So it might be challenging to actually do that. There are things you can do, but I don't think there's going to be a guaranteed way for you to get their email address, which ideally is by design. Hopefully you shouldn't actually be able to get their email address. It is a possibility that, you know, mail is floating in different ways. Sometimes that can actually be a scam as well. It may not actually be a legitimate email going to somebody else. Somebody may actually be sending a scam and just wanting you to open it, because curiosity is the one thing that anyone who's running a phishing scam would want to do. They want you to be curious enough to open it. And if you open it, there could be something else running around. So I'm not saying that's the case, although, you know, definitely if you did open anything that you're unsure of, run a virus scan or anything in that case. But most likely you're not going to be able to get their email address, because most of the companies won't want to deliver that. You can guess and you can email a few addresses and, you know, state, I think you might be getting, or I've been getting your email. But even then you may or may not receive a response. So I can't think of a really great way for you to do that, although you can, I think what you're doing, which is alerting the individuals that you sent it to the wrong location, is a good step for them to update their records, but also think about those groups sending you those emails, because they might not be real. You could be sending replies to something that could be malicious. I'm not saying that's the case. It's just a possibility.
Yeah. Good things to think about, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. John in Brown Deer, turning to you next. Hi, John.
Hi, Mr. Mueller, and thank you for accepting my call. And I have a technical question for your guest, and it has to do with the Piriform C Cleaner. And I'm using the free version of this application, and recently, I updated to the next highest application, which, of course, was free. And then I was receiving, when I would access and open my CCleaner, it would ask me if I wanted further updates or something else, and I would always say no and proceed with doing my business, internet business and computer business, and everything is fine. But recently I received a message when my computer opens. The message reads, do you want this application to make changes to your hard drive, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to be legitimate. It comes from, the publisher is Piriform, and it has some links on the actual executable message that says, do I want certificate information, and do I want further information, and I get the location where it's stored on my hard drive, and I get the information regarding the certificate, and it says this certificate is legitimate, and then when I open the various places on the on the information drop-down menu, when I right-click on shortcut for the CCleaner, I go to the various places, and it the properties, and I go through all of the property applications there, and everything seems to be legitimate. And then I read some of the other information, and it doesn't interfere with my computer workings at all. All it does is appear on my initial screen on opening, and any time I click on to open the Piriform cleaner, it gives me that message, and I can't open the Piriform cleaner. It doesn't work as long as I haven't downloaded that executable. So I'm curious. I'm very hesitant to click on things like that before going through some type of thorough check to see if it is legitimate.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the things you've already done so far to, you know, validate the trust of the software, kind of what it's doing, are really, really good steps. And Piriform is the company that actually makes CCleaner. So it's parent company, and you can get more information about it online. It's most likely some kind of valid add-on or application that they have. What I'd probably recommend doing in this case, because some of the things it's doing feel kind of annoying, I would actually recommend if Piriform in any way, shape, or form is actually installed, especially since it doesn't work, try to uninstall it. Go to your control panel, remove the software. I'd actually do the same thing with CCleaner, uninstall it, and download a later version. One, just to make sure you have the latest software release with the latest updates, and then hopefully it might resolve some of those further notifications. Who knows, it could have been a bug, it could be some other problem that showed up. I would recommend removing them, install the latest version of CCleaner. Hopefully that resolves that issue in the future. In this case, it kind of feels like it's a little bit of a bug. I don't think it's anything malicious, but always just to be safe, run any kind of virus scanner that you have. If you have Windows Defender or a different software application, just make sure you have a completely clean system, and I would uninstall those software packages and just reinstall the latest CCleaner.
There you go, John. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. We've got open lines to get you on really quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. You got a new job here, Jesse. I wanted to bring that up before I forget about it. You were at the UW-Madison. Now you're at Madison College.
Yes.
How's it over there?
It's good. It's a different visibility into a different educational sector. Madison College and UW-Madison are both widely utilized educational centers, and it's good to see a different perspective and different ways that things are being done, which is, you know, with security, you always have to question kind of everything you're doing, because one thing you believe in one day could be incorrect. So you always need to validate yourself and what you're thinking and how you're getting to a conclusion. You don't want to, you know, put in additional risk where it's not warranted. So actually looking at a different institution and how they do it helps me to question myself, which is really, really valuable to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have Natalie in Eau Claire just joining us, so let's go to her. Natalie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks. I'm coming in late to the show, so I'm not sure if this was already asked or where it fits in. But I have a question. We just bought a new Wi-Fi router, so we just have, you know, basic internet for our home, and we thought a new router, because our other one was quite old, probably more than 10 years old. We would think that that would help our very few devices connect in our house, and still we're having issues with our smartphones loading slowly. Netflix is constantly stopping and reloading. So our internet provider doesn't have any other suggestions for us that we haven't already tried as far as like unplugging our router and modem and replugging in. And I'm just curious if there's anything else we can do to speed up the Wi-Fi speed in our house. It's a very small house as well, so it's not like we're covering a large area.
Yeah.
Do you have any devices that are directly plugged into your cable modem or any other devices?
No.
What I would do first is just try plugging in directly into your cable modem. Verify your current speed. If it turns out that your current speed is actually slow, any kind of wireless improvements aren't going to matter. So mm-hmm. I would try to do that first. And you're basically going to do it the same way you plug in your router into your cable modem, or in this case, your wireless router, wireless access point. Plug a laptop, plug any kind of device in, do an internet speed check. There's a variety of services. Then I would actually plug in your wireless router back into that spot, try one of your wireless devices, use the same service to do a speed test and see what the difference is. If it turns out it's actually your internet itself that's slow, well, that's something you'll unfortunately need to work out with your existing internet provider. But it'll at least tell you if it's the wireless signal or not. If it turns out to be the wireless signal, there's a lot of other questions in terms of the house construction, because anything in the walls can actually reduce the wireless signal, meaning you might want to put the wireless router in a different physical location, and that kind of gets into, you know, where are things plugged in and how can you move things around to get the best signal where you need it the most.
But sometimes what is advertised, the speed that you are supposed to be receiving may not be the speed that you're actually getting.
Correct. Some internet providers do have, you're always going to get this speed or above. But sometimes it's very dependent upon load, meaning that the more people using it, generally the slower it's going to be because everyone's sharing the same lane. If you have the lane to yourself, it's pretty easy. When you have 100 or 1,000 or 100,000 other people using it, it can slow down quite a bit. So it could be the usage, but that's also, you know, a good reason to plug your device directly into your router, because it takes wireless completely out of the question, because you might not actually have issues with your wireless. You might actually have issues with your internet connection itself.
Yeah. Does that help out, Natalie?
It does. I'm just curious, you mentioned an internet speed check and there are multiple services. How do I find one of those? Do I just go online and plug in internet speed check test?
Generally, that's what I do. and, you know, with a lot of things on the internet, you just never know if anything is, you know, valid or not. Sometimes your ISP actually does have their own speed test, which you can actually get directly from them, which is good for a variety of reasons to test their internet speed. Whenever I Google it, I always use Ookla, which is the first one that shows up. So if you actually Google speed test, it's going to just be the first one. I've used that in the past before. It's worked well, but most of them out there are going to do what you need them to do.
Yeah, there you go, Natalie. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. And, boy, here we are out of time. Jesse, it's always a pleasure. You're going to be back on November 5th.
Yes.
If I am not mistaken, and we will do this all over again. Thanks so much for being with us today. Jesse LeGrew is an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He assists with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. So great to have him with us. He will be back on November 5th. Tomorrow we'll be talking with a couple of attorneys about bankruptcy and taking your legal questions. Well, I hope you'll tune in for that. That's at 11 tomorrow on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.